Welcome, Capital Raisers. On today's show, Brandon Bruckman comes on and breaks down registered investment advisors, also known as RIAs, and everything about the business, including when you can partner with them on syndications. We also went into emotional versus logical decision-making for investors. If you would like to explore partnerships with me, talk shop about capital raising, or hire me as a coach, use the scheduling link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show, episode 251, and it starts now. Rock and roll, I got Brandon Bruckman on the Capital Raiser Show. My friend, how the heck are you today, dude?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's going to be a blast. And I just went on your show, Retiring Real Estate Investor Podcast. So we might chat a little bit about that at some point throughout the episode. But hey, man, tell us a little bit about your background, man. How did you get into this thing called real estate investing and investments and raising capital and stuff?
What a roundabout way to kind of arrive here. My training is classical finance, and I've worked at a hedge fund for many years, and we didn't even talk about real estate investment at a personal level at all. And so I knew nothing. And so I sort of walked out of that experience and really didn't get exposed to this until my business partner, who his family had ran some hotels in Kansas and had this little problem with 1031 exchange. And then that launched us into sort of this business to understand what it means to invest in real estate. As an individual, I had no idea that this 1031 exchange was something that you could do. I had no idea the impact of depreciation and mortgage interest deductions. I'm like, oh my gosh, these are almost tax-free returns that you're getting out of real estate. And yeah, no one told me. I skipped that class in college somewhere. I don't know, or it didn't exist.
Okay, cool. So one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on, man, is because you are or were an RIA. Are you still an RIA?
We are. So I'll describe a little bit the firm and sort of what we're up to. Yeah, as an RIA, as a registered investment advisor, not the typical person you hear talking about real estate, but a big portion of our business is helping real estate investors that are actively managing properties, helping them get passive. And so they'll turn around and sell those properties, look to perform a 1031 exchange to defer those taxes and invest in passive assets that are eligible for that transaction. And so we're helping them quarterback their way through it and helping them select those passive assets on the backside. So huge benefit for them. They get to retire. They get passive income. They get to not pay that tax right now. It's a great setup. And so we're privileged to help folks kind of walk through and do that.
Okay. So we're going to definitely explore this industry. I was raising for Matt Faircloth on a 670 unit portfolio. And we got in touch with this one particular gentleman who had heard about the podcast and was very interested in, said that I came highly recommended. And he was an RIA for multiple people and had some guy, I think from India, that had a soap business and wanted to start placing his money into real estate because he was wasting his money on a lot of things and didn't manage it correctly and was buying anything and wanted to buy his own apartment complex without even knowing how to manage it, which is kind of like the mom and pop kind of investor mentality. You become really rich, like I want to park my money in real estate. And obviously I have so much that I might as well buy an apartment complex, but he had no idea what he was doing. So he was going to write a $1 million check. And we had numerous conversations with him. And we were like, are you sure you want to invest in this? You're ready to rock and roll? And he's like, absolutely, man. Where do I wire the check? And then we never got it. But I was very fascinated because this is my first experience with an RIA. We said to him, hey, we can pay you or make you a part owner of the fund and or portfolio and or our investment vehicle into this portfolio. And he's like, I don't get paid that way. The way that I get paid as an RIA is for managing my investors' money. So I will not be participating with you on the capital raise side of things or doing any ongoing duties in this deal. And I was very curious about that. So tell me, how does this whole RIA thing work? I'm curious about getting into real estate investing as an RIA for your investors, because this, like you said earlier, it's not typical. So typically you guys are selling stocks, bonds, or other things. And then you guys are brokers, I believe, in some cases where you guys are forced to sell the investments of your broker and nothing else. Tell me about this. What do I need to know?
Yeah, we'll hold that broker thing to aside for a second. I'll come back to that. But I think it's important what you mentioned about RIAs and the way that we're compensated. So as a registered investment advisor, I am a fiduciary to my clients. And what does that mean? That means by law, I have to do what's in their best interest all the time, every time. Now, frankly, I would do that anyways. But so that standard is a standard that's above other financial professionals that exist. So think about somebody that maybe, and no offense to these folks, but somebody who may work at an Edward Jones is a broker, and a broker only has to do what's suitable for you. There's a subtle difference in that. What's suitable for you may not necessarily be in your best interest. So I'll let other folks decide what they think about conflict of interest there. But since I'm a fiduciary, I'm only compensated by my clients. So in the scenario that you described, I would never want to be part of that fundraising or a GP in that setup, because that's a conflict of interest. And that's what's been laid out to us as we've explored this from a legal perspective and what it means to be a fiduciary. And that's a lot of the feedback that we've gotten from our legal, is that we need to continue to be a neutral party here. So a lot of my role is analyzing deals such as yours and thinking about what's in our investors' best interest and where to invest it. I think a lot of RIAs don't act in this space because a lot have that traditional training where they probably don't own real estate. They're not aware of the benefits of direct real estate ownership. They're likely not even aware that syndication is a possibility for their investors. It's an awareness issue and probably a comfort issue as well. It's a lot more comfortable for RIAs to know and suggest what they know. And what they know is some sort of investing in public markets, you know, be it stocks, ETFs, bonds, et cetera, is just a more comfort space for them to sort of be in. But I think if more RIAs were exposed to the space and had an open mind about it, I think there'd be a ton of interest.
Okay, so interesting from my myopic view, I'm thinking about raising capital, which I could potentially do from RIAs, but I don't work with them the same way that I would with a co-GP or with a fund or an institution, because you guys are compensated on a different side of things by the people that you work for and manage their money, which is a fascinating concept. But in your case, tell us a little bit about how it would be structured, or why would you want to direct your investors or clients' money into real estate, you know, versus something like a stock market? And why or why not are other RIAs not doing so?
I think for us, it's very simple. Like the economics there for owning some of these real estate investments in a syndication structure provides some of those same tax benefits as well. So when we put that on a page with, you know, what you're seeing currently in stocks, it's not even a hard question. As you've seen the return patterns that we've seen in 2022, and we saw another rather large hiccup in 2020 in the equity market. So we want to think about allocations holistically to start with. So if our investors have no real estate exposure whatsoever and are accredited and would be suitable for them to be in a syndication, we definitely want to start looking at that. And so we'll start to introduce that concept. So I think about it more of a top-down look at a full portfolio. I don't think you can be fully diversified if you're only invested in equities in the stock market. That's not diversification. I can't get it there. So there's an easy place for me to get it somewhere else, and that's syndication. And we'd love that to be part of people's portfolios if they're able and it qualifies for them. So again, I think just a lot of RIAs don't look at this space because it's just a lack of knowledge and understanding and probably ability to analyze these things. So we'll spend quite a bit of time doing our homework. That's where I expect to add value for our clients and for us to get paid. It's not simply making a recommendation for syndications, but sorting out which ones we believe are good, which ones we believe may have some struggles.
Okay. So then how do you get your RIA designation? What is that process like?
Not hard at all. The only license that we need is a Series 65. So that's a multiple part test that needs to be passed. And then you could register at a state level that you may be in. So we're registering multiple state levels where we can operate and do business. Once you exceed a certain level of assets, you're registered at a federal level and with the SEC. So not too hard of a hurdle to achieve that Series 65.
And then, so how do you grow your client database? What is your approach?
A lot of traditional marketing efforts that you would think that folks would go after is the same thing that we're doing. A lot of networking inside of our locales, talking to a ton of CPAs, a lot of real estate lawyers as well, looking for some of these clients, and then making sure we're well connected with other organizations. LinkedIn's been an amazing place for us to be as well. I'm introducing some of these concepts too. So yeah, a lot of the same ways that I think a lot of capital raisers are going about their networking is similar to what we're doing.
So what kind of a return are you attempting to get for your clients?
It all varies on a person and what they're trying to achieve. So that's sort of our starting point. It's like, okay, why are you investing? Like, well, what's the point? Yes, we all want to make as much money as possible. Great, got it. But for what? What are we trying to achieve? So it's starting with a plan first and sort of starting to work our way back from that. All right, well, what do we need to achieve on an annual basis to reach our goal in, say, 20 years? What does that number look like? And so we'll sort of work our way from there. And that's really about it. It's an individual risk tolerance factor as well. So we try our best to factor that in. We don't predict the future. But we have decent metrics that can help us understand what volatility could look like and what people can handle. So that's a big component too of the returns that we're trying to achieve is what folks can handle. Because the worst thing that can happen here is we get halfway through this and folks go, whoa, that's more than I can deal with and bail. So that's an easy way for them to not achieve their plan is to do that. So getting those levels of comfort is really the place that we're trying to get to. And then just find a number to help achieve goals. That's why we invest. We invest to get somewhere and to be somewhere. And it's figuring out what that is.
So I have a friend, Corey Peterson, who's got a background in financial trading. He's moved into syndication and now has a very successful syndication business. However, he is used to shopping for his investors in the same pool where people are in stocks and bonds, where their typical goal is to make 4 to 8%. And that's exactly the same return that he offers them. Versus a lot of syndicators, they're really trying to get like 17 to 20% return on investment or higher and are basically training their investors that is what they should expect. And Corey is of very much of the mindset is, hey, if I can put somebody's money, get them tax benefits, get them into real estate, I don't need to offer them 17 to 18 to 20%. I can very happily give them 8% or a 6 and 12 is what he calls. I believe 6% up preferred and 12% IRR or something like that. Tell me about this particular concept. If you ever became a syndicator, do you think that you would have the same mindset? Or let me hear your thoughts on that.
You'd be surprised what 6 to 8% compounding can do for you. And so the idea of offering that consistently is more appealing than it may seem. So I question the ability for syndicators to, and for investors to expect consistent 20% plus IRRs. That's pretty tough. And especially like it's tough when you're starting to talk about bigger numbers. It's not achievable once the numbers get bigger. It's just math and it can't happen. So I love the concept of training us to think about a return that's a little bit more conservative and is more realistic and is more consistent because that's what we're really looking for. If we can have consistent long-term returns, even if they are a bit lower in the range that you described as opposed to the 20% that always gets advertised, we're going to be doing pretty well. We'll grow our money pretty darn well doing that. So I like that concept. This reminds me of a story of a hedge fund managed futures type trader had a firm and a strategy that he would run. And it was a little too volatile for investors, but made a ton of money. He actually turned the dial down to make it less volatile and offer less return. That was more appealing to the investors. And they were able to better stick with that strategy, even though it was technically making less money and less returns. So there's something to be said about a little bit about our psychology and the way that we approach this and our expectations has a lot to say about what we achieve. Investing for the long haul and that constant compounding, that's when we're going to win. And so is whatever we can do to help us stick with that, all the better.
Fascinating. Okay, cool. When I was on your podcast, I mentioned an MBA study that we did. And if you interview 1,000 capital raisers, they'll never do this. I want to bring this up one more time just so that my audience can also hear it again, which is Andy McMullen, my partner, got connected with an MBA group and they wanted to do research on real estate. So we kind of had them do a SWOT analysis on our competitors. We gave them a list of 10 syndicators that are our friends and or competitors. Typically, they're our friends. And they started coming back with all of this zoning laws and market analysis and really didn't give us any information that we found useful. So we kind of rephrased the assignment to them and said, hey, we're going to give you this fake scenario where you have $50,000. And you're going to have to invest it by the end of the year because you have a taxable event coming up and you want to get the benefits of cost segregation and other ways to benefit from taxes in the real estate game. But you have to park your money before the end of the year. And they had 2 months to do research on all of our competitors, and we found that these MBAs went through a very emotional roller coaster because they had to figure out who to invest with and why. We were asking them, if you decide to invest with somebody, tell us why. This is what we were trying to figure out. This is our SWOT analysis, how we could figure out how to improve ourselves as a company. And what we found is very interesting. If it was an Indian MBA student, a lot of times they wanted to invest with an Indian syndicator. Or if they were an Asian woman, they wanted to invest with an Asian woman syndicator. If they were a doctor or an MBA, they wanted to invest with other doctors and MBAs and that kind of a thing. So we found that very fascinating. But there was three results of this, is that they invest emotionally based off of who the person and whether or not they relate to them. They also invested in whether or not they could get a hold of the sponsor. I remember one of the MBA students got on a phone call with Zach Kaptenstall for 45 minutes. This guy in Phoenix, it's got $1.3 billion worth of assets, spent 45 minutes with one of our MBA students. She was very fascinated by the fact that she could get this billionaire operator on the phone. And that speaks volumes of whether or not you should invest with somebody when you get the actual operator, not a secretary or investor relations guy on the phone. And then the last part was that they really liked visual. Some of them were very visual. So they liked websites that kind of explained track record and explained the whole process of investing. And they had like video drone footage of their A-class buildings. So the reason that I bring this up is because when I brought this up on your podcast, you were talking about the emotional roller coaster of the investor experience. And sometimes that kind of will taint your decision making. So talk to us about this particular concept, because somebody might come to you and say, hey, I got $1 million that I want to invest. And they may make emotional versus logical or theoretically best investment decisions for themselves because of their interest in partnering or working with somebody like them instead of what is best for them.
100%. So there's a lot to unpack there. So I want to start with, I think as human beings holistically, we make horrible decisions with conditions of uncertainty. We make horrible decisions with conditions of uncertainty. We don't have a process to do this. And so I think that's what starts our brains go fried a little bit and we start to go emotional. I don't think there's a good solid process for folks to follow that has proven results for them to feel comfortable with. Even if we go through our process on an investment, we will have some syndication at some point in the life cycle of our firm that is not going to go well, because that's just the law of numbers. We've done 200 plus transactions in some form of syndication. Something there is not going to go right. I just know it. So it's a matter of, I don't think that people are comfortable with the fact that things may not work out right every single time. And I think that's what kind of leads to this, some of these decisions and emotions and biases that I don't think investors see. And so this is inevitable for us on, you know, every single investor we deal with. Some are making humongous life decisions that they've never made before. They've never done a syndication. They've never decided on making a 10-year decision in many cases. This stuff's scary. That's a frightening thing to do. And it's something that I can't undo 3 months from now. And so I think immediately people go to emotion. It's incumbent upon me, and I think this is for other capital raisers and syndicators as well, to recognize that and say, oh, okay, I understand where people's emotions are going to come into play. And I understand where logic might be defined that I think is logical, or I think is quantitative, or maybe violates my process. I have to be conscious of that. And so we do our best to put guardrails up for investors to say, hey, here's a list of things we've approved. Here's a list of things we have not approved. And here's why. And so if we can keep our investors on a list of things that we approved, we're doing okay. So even inside of there, they may make decisions that I wouldn't 100% agree with. Some investors ask us to force rank them, rank these investments 1 through 10. I'm like, I can't, because these are personal decisions to you. What I've decided is they're okay for you to invest in. You have to make a personal decision whether you think this makes sense or not. So we kind of give investors a little bit of room to be emotional, to exercise their bias a little bit. We give them room to do that, but with guardrails. It's sort of like bumper bowling. We know it's going to get down to the end of the alley. We're just not quite sure how it's going to get there yet. At least it's on our lane. And if we can do that, I think we're doing okay.
Fascinating. Okay, so what are you doing from your perspective? Take us through the process of vetting a syndicator. or making the decision to select somebody that you would offer their products and investments to one of your clients? What are you looking at?
Yeah, pretty deep process. So I'll go like summary high level stuff. Track record is very important to us. And so we're sort of starting there of a verifiable track record. We're starting on full cycle deals. It's really what we want to see. We want to see everything in process too. We want to talk to as many current investors as possible. We're doing full background checks on individuals. So we're making sure that we're dealing with good people. That's the starting point. Beyond that, we are looking at experience beyond track record. What have you done before? Who's part of your team? We're looking at an infrastructure that's associated with that. I prefer some level of corporate infrastructure and vertical integration that you may have. That's a plus. So we're looking at all those things, and eventually I'm probably going to come out and see you. So I want to see your market. I want to see how you interact with your team. I want to see where the opportunity is that you see and sort of try to understand that. That's sort of the starting point. And we have a variety of people that we've approved as call them sponsors or syndicators. That doesn't necessarily mean we approve every deal they do, right? So these are two very different things that we're sort of doing the analysis on. We think both is equally as important. So there are some syndicators and sponsors that have deals that we don't frankly want to do. And we look at and we're just like, this one doesn't make sense. We still like you based on what you've shown and displayed to us, but what you're doing here doesn't make a lot of sense. So we're taking those as two really separate parts. But to summarize that, I mean, it's really about understanding the thesis, the opportunity, the track record, the experience. And if there's a corporate infrastructure, a bit of a corporate infrastructure there, that makes sense, all the better.
Do syndicators ever come to you and say, hey, we have this deal. Tell me about, how do they even find you or know to look for you?
Man, they find me. there's no shortage of deal flow that we're seeing. I think LinkedIn has been a big part of that. We dove into LinkedIn pretty heavy at the beginning of the pandemic. A lot of things we would do from, you mentioned a question about where do we find people. A lot of presentations were in person. So we were speaking to 100 plus person room of potential clients and talking to them about what we do. Obviously we couldn't do that anymore. So the next best substitute for that has been for us LinkedIn and the podcast alley has been great for us. So I think a lot of the exposure that we've created on LinkedIn has created folks coming to us, because I'm still seeing 3 to 4 deals a week, at least. No issues there.
For the aspiring capital raiser out there, or a person even with a track record, would you suggest or not suggest that they come to and look for RIAs to potentially work with?
I think so. I wonder how easy or hard that would be. There's capital sources there, and I would leave no stone unturned if I'm doing that. So I think the advantage of working with someone like us is I'm turning around and working with a 300 plus basis of clients behind me. So I can be a chunkier form of capital raising and allocating than going to individuals. So I think it's something that syndicators should definitely dig for and try to find. I think we're going to be hard to find though. I haven't gone looking for us yet, so I don't know, but I think we're going to be hard to find.
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to have a few find me. So it's kind of, you become the magnet and people will find you or hear about you depending on how good of a business you run and what kind of marketing and authority exposure you create for yourself. So podcast is a great way to get yourself on people's radar, guys, for anybody that's thinking about starting a podcast. I'm curious about this, Brandon. I'd like to know, what are your personal investment goals in terms of real estate? Do you want to be a passive investor? Do you want to at some point become active? Do you want to be an RIA for the rest of your life? Do you want to get into syndication? Tell me more about you personally.
I'm fortunate in that I will, in many cases, invest alongside with our clients. So I get to do a lot of this homework selfishly for myself, which is great, and learn about these. No one wants me to be their landlord. That would be a nightmare. So I'm very fortunate to have the ability to invest passively and in syndications. I don't see myself ever directly owning investment property. I think that would be a disaster for all of us. I'm not Bob Vila, to say the least, and I'm probably not the nicest when it comes to the first of the month for rent collections. I don't think that would go well. So I'll stay away from that for the time being. But like from a larger perspective, my goal has always been multiple generational wealth. And so I want, yeah, that's a fun one, right? Mm-hmm. So I want my kids' kids and their kids' kids to say, wow, that Grandpa Brandon did pretty good job of setting us up. So I want that for our family. It's interesting. We did way before you had 21andMe and all these other sites about your heritage. Our uncle went through a study of our background very deep, and you could see where wealth was created and then eliminated, created and then eliminated. And I'm like, wow, there it is in real time. The statistics that you hear about are real. And I can see them on the paper where there's wealth created for a generation or two, and then it was gone. So I'd like to break some of those statistics or trends. Would be great. I can't think of a better way right now than doing that through real estate syndications.
Okay, very cool. Why don't we talk a little bit about your podcast? You're an RIA and you have a podcast about the retiring real estate investor. Seems contradictory considering most RIAs are in equities, stocks, and bonds. Tell me, why did you start one on real estate specifically?
So I mentioned after 2020, we got pretty big on LinkedIn and I was doing a lot of podcasts. For our area and being who we are, no one really has a podcast there that's sizable and successful. It's like the last frontier of podcasting. So we're like, why not? So we'll be talking to syndicators and sponsors on there. We'll be talking to some actual retiring real estate investors and learning about their journey. And then we'll be talking a lot in depth about, you know, our due diligence process. We're going to go pretty deep there. And so we'll have a couple of our analysts on there and we'll walk through deals. So I think people will find that either really nerdy or really interesting, or maybe both.
Okay, cool. So when you're out getting clients, do you want to be extremely sharp dressed? Do you want to be, you know, base it off of your credibility and track record and walk around in flip-flops like Rod Cleef does? Or you want to be more like a August Binias where you're always in a suit? What's the right level for you?
I think it's for everybody. It's like, be who you are. I think a lot of that stigma is like gone now. So I dress like this. So you'll see a lot of like dark polos. That's just the way I dress, for better or worse. My business partner down in Kansas City, Josh Wright, a lot of flamingo shirts, a lot of weird Hawaiian shirts going on. Not my style. Works for him though, man, and all the better, right? So do whatever people are comfortable in, I think is plenty fine. I mean, I'll throw a sports coat on if I'm presenting in front of a group, but man, I just come as I am.
Yeah, authenticity is kind of a big deal. So, I mean, people can tell when you're trying to use a specific language that is not yours. I mean, I say dude and brother and what's up and talk with my old skateboard kind of lingo and I'm all stoked about certain things. And that is me. Yeah. Even like I go into topics about spirituality, that is me. Like I want to talk about the things that I love. And yeah, I know that's not going to resonate with everyone. But for the people that are looking for somebody authentic, at least they know that they're going to get me. And I think that's exactly what you're trying to impress upon the people in the audience.
100%. And it's sneakily some of the things that we look for when we're evaluating sponsors and syndicators too. I'm secretly, when I go on some of these trips, hopefully they're not listening to this part, but I'm watching how you interact with your team. I'm watching how your team interacts with you. And I'm watching to make sure that it has some level of authenticity to it, that your team's excited about the mission that you're working on. It's just as much important for me to ask questions on those trips as it is for me to observe. And it's probably more important for me to observe than anything. So yeah, it comes through even in that area as well.
How about this last question before we jump into the lightning round? How important is it when you're looking at working with a sponsor as to whether or not they are great sponsors that are good at what they do, but on top of that, they are also doing good, creating impact? They're focused on residents and making the experience, not wearing a hat that says rents due, but actually like going to the property and throwing the residents parties and or getting them a food truck or, you know, creating a environment that is, you know, conducive to growing a family and or donating a portion of their returns that they make to charity. Anything like that important to you, or is it all return based?
That's hugely important to us because we believe that great sponsors are embedded into their communities. And we believe that that goodwill extends itself to a longer term relationship that we want to have with them, that they want to have with that community and to residents. That will actually translate into returns. It may not be tomorrow. It may not be next month, but over the long haul, it will. And so, yeah, that's very important to us. We're watching for that. And folks that aren't embedded in their community and are just squeezing every last dime they can out of tenants, I don't think they're going to be successful over the long haul. And so it's very important to us.
Okay, cool. I want to bring something up real quick because I've said this to numerous sponsors and they complete agreement with me because sometimes when you're vetting a sponsor, especially earlier in the game, you see that they are taking care of the residents, that they're doing some really nice things for them, sending them anniversary and birthday cards, and maybe providing turkeys like we are for our residents for Thanksgiving, and like maybe a gift card for Christmas or something like that, especially in the early days while we're developing a bunch of neighboring houses around them in the built rent space. But what you find out is, even though these people seem like they're very spiritually aligned and they're great people and they have great business model and they've have a track record of returns, you get into business with them, and then you find out that their communication infrastructure for their limited partners is horrible. And even though they created a 25% IRR, the investors don't come back because the experience is so horrible. They can't get anybody to answer the phone or respond to an email or see what's going on with the property. And when somebody's got $50,000 or $150,000 worth of their nest egg on the line, that can be a very freaky experience for them. So are you vetting people for their communication structure, or talk to me about this?
It's one of the first things I mentioned. We invest alongside our investors. I'll invest before them. And I'll invest for that particular reason, is I want to understand that communication infrastructure and reporting infrastructure. So yeah, that's a big factor. You'd be surprised. So the call I was on before this was with a client who has 40 plus syndicated investments with us and who is irritated because one of them won't send a wire properly and he received a check in the mail. Does that have anything to do with performance? No. Is that a big deal? No. Is it irritating to him? Yes. So I emphasize this for sponsors and syndicators. Straighten out the back office, man, and communicate and over-communicate. It's just a distraction you don't want. So eliminate it, period.
Oh, I like that. All right, cool, man. Let's jump into the lightning round. My first question for you is, what is the best vacation you have ever taken?
Gosh, I went for like a decade without taking a vacation, as sad as that sounds. So yeah, we've been better about this. So the last two we've taken as a family have been great. Cocoa Beach, tons of fun, and then Gulf Shores. We had an absolute blast. So I'll put those two at the top of the list for now, and we'll one up it maybe next year.
Gulf Shores, Alabama?
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, like 10 miles away from there, we're building a subdivision, actually. So Foley, Alabama. Interesting.
Oh, awesome.
I'm glad to hear that people like Gulf Shores.
That sounds like a group vacation right there, dude. You can. That sounds like a business trip.
Favorite book of any kind?
There's so many, and I'm sneaking like a peek over my shoulder here, but I'm going to say the one I'm looking at right now is from Robert Greene. It's called The 48 Laws of Power.
Oh, I would
highly recommend that for folks that might feel a little stuck in W-2 land with a larger company. I would highly recommend they read their way through that book. That will teach them how to navigate some of the political games that they may be having to deal with that are inevitable with that many people in a corporate environment. That book will give them a lot of help on that.
Good to hear that. That book is actually in my Amazon saved for later. So I'm going to go ahead, now that I've heard it again, I'm going to go ahead and put that into my cart and purchase that sucker. All right. Tell me the craziest thing that you've seen during your travels, if you've seen anything unusual.
I've traveled a lot in the history of my work. And I think the wildest thing I've seen is in the streets of Baltimore. I could have ridden that rat down the street with a saddle on. And I'm not a small dude, right? I'm kind of a big dude, man. I would have had no problem saddling up and riding that rat. That's the biggest sucker I've ever seen. That was the one that sort of sticks out in my mind. Baltimore rats are greater than New York City rats any day of the week.
Wow. Okay, cool. Best way to raise capital from your perspective, short answer on this.
Family and friends is a start point for syndicators. I think they should start there. And then I think they should build a 5-year roadmap to start raising capital from bigger and stickier capital sources.
Can you tell me about a moment that changed the trajectory of your life?
Just one. I think early on, maybe I realized, and this is through reading a lot of like 48 Laws of Power and Ego is the Enemy and books of that nature. Maybe I didn't treat people that well in a corporate environment setting or in a work setting, and maybe a little bit too aggressive. Maybe that's an understatement. So once I sort of realized that a little bit, it sort of made my interactions with folks a lot easier. So I think that was kind of a big turning point when I realized maybe I was kind of a, to some folks, kind of a big turning point.
I would actually consider myself not the greatest human being back in the day, and doing some personal development where they basically forced me to look in the mirror and see a reflection of the way I was showing up, particularly in the past life. is one of the greatest things that has ever happened to me for changing the way that I operate today. And now I'm a spiritual guy, and I'm all about creating good in the world. And I think I always had a sense of that. But when you get that opportunity to look at yourself and see how you are screwing up and not operating at your best level, that really helps kind of sometimes. It can be really life-changing, where you go from somebody who's not proud of some of the things that they've done in the past to someone who's very proud of the way that they're operating today. So it's not shameful or embarrassing to look back at yourself, in my opinion, guys, ladies and gentlemen, that you have some vulnerabilities and things that you've learned from that allow you to be a better version of yourself today. So that's a great answer. Thank you for being vulnerable. It's really important that people are like this. Seriously, guys. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're sort of intertwined. So when I cleaned up maybe some of that behavior, what I find is you're missing some of that. All the motivation and the self-help and all that work is great. I think what I found was I was missing sort of that spiritual component as well. So I dove back into faith in a lot deeper way. And yeah, that has a lot to do with it. Dude, I pray for my clients. I pray for them to make good decisions. I pray for them to have favorable results. I pray for us to have the ability to give them guidance to make good decisions. That matters. It matters a lot. So yeah, I encourage people to explore that as well.
What do you love best about being a dad?
For those of you that aren't parents, never in your life has there been bigger highs and then subsequently bigger frustrations and lows than being a parent. And all of it's great. All of it's great. So I encourage folks to get in on that. It's just awesome stuff. It's cool for me to watch. Like, my wife laments when they're getting older. I love watching them develop and become better human beings, and better human beings than I am. And that's awesome. It's totally awesome.
Very cool. All right, do you have any hacks for breaking through limiting beliefs?
I keep reading a lot of these books that we keep talking about. I would do a lot of that. And then I'd kind of step outside yourself just for a minute. It's probably not that important or that critical or that dire of a circumstance, or it's probably not that intimidating when you step outside yourself and look at yourself. So whatever, but folks are like, oh, I can't do that. Well, somebody did it. And it's more likely than not, they're probably just as smart or capable as you are, maybe even less so. So it's probably, you can probably do it. It just takes the ability to understand that the folks that we look at that have achieved all these things, they're just human beings too, man. And so we all can kind of do what we want to do.
All right, trademark question coming up here. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
No near-death experiences. And I'm using this to stall on a miracle. Dude, I think about what we're doing right now, man. Like, here you and I are talking on a computer about all these awesome ways to make our lives better. Is that not a miracle in that itself? Not to be cliche or whatever or corny, but it kind of is. Like, this stuff's pretty awesome that we're able to do right now. So never been a better time to be alive. I guess that in and of itself is a miracle. We get to be here right now.
That's actually the answer that I'm always looking for.
Oh,
right?
Good.
Is life itself a miracle? I mean, the fact that you're floating around on this little blue bubble, going around millions of miles an hour around a universe that's expanding, experiencing consciousness in mostly empty space, that is a miracle. Every day is a miracle. The fact that we can breathe and stay healthy and have our parents alive in some cases, or somebody that you love being alive, that is a miracle every single day. So be grateful for that is my invitation to you. Last question of the day brought to you by Shanna Amigo. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
The generational wealth thing is big for our family, so I'd love to leave that. I think that's a little bit to be determined. We got some ideas on that betterment front that we're thinking about here. So I'm gonna leave that open-ended and a little bit to be determined at this point. We haven't quite gotten there yet. We're working on it.
Fantastic answers on the lightning round. Thanks for entertaining us on that part of the show. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation, to my company Legacy Acquisitions, and to our sponsors, Good Egg Investment Syndication, Pro Apartment Educators, the Family Office Club, and PitchDex.com. Go check out their offers at thecapitalraisershow.com. Brandon, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
A lot of easy ways. LinkedIn, easy to just look me up. The website's investwithinsight.com. Brandon@investwithinsight.com. Shoot me a note. Easy to find me.
Okay, so real quick, before we finish off, I'm curious about the Retiring Real Estate Investor podcast. I had a blast coming on that show, talking shop about build to rent and all kinds of other things. What other kinds of people are you having on there? Are they all real estate guys? Are there some people that are in Bitcoin or anything like that? Who is your ideal guest, or what kind of interview do you like to do on that show?
Yeah, sponsors and syndicators first. some of our clients or prospective clients are great too. So retiring real estate investors are going through it. We love to hear from. And then you'll hear a lot from us about sort of what we're doing and describing the process in a lot more detail. But yeah, a lot of real estate folks, that's who we really want to hear from. They're putting deals together. It's great exposure for them to our client base.
Okay. Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser or multifamily syndicator as they scale in their journey?
Oh, I wish you so much luck right now. Financing world's got, the world's turned upside down on you. And I encourage us to have had a lot of conversations about it recently. It's all right. The playing field will shift and change. Adjust and adapt to that quickly. So I think the quicker that syndicators can figure that out, you are going to be in the front of the boat to raise capital. So be aggressive and be on the lookout for the ability to get great deals still for investors. Those are out there and there will be more.
Oh, that was a fun show, man. I appreciate you coming on, my friend.
Oh, I love it. Thank you so much.
All right, cool. With that, we're going to wish you a great day, dude. Thanks you for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review, guys. All right, Brandon, we'll check you out pretty soon, my friend.
All right. Thank you, sir.